This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 16th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 383. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, British Columbia's 43rd Parliament opens February 18th. One of the hot topics in question period during this session will be the NDP government's drug policy, public health, and public safety. 2 years after the Trudeau Liberals and the EBNDP imposed the drug decriminalization experiment. My guest is addiction and mental health expert, Dr. Julian Summers of Simon Fraser University. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. After 278 days, the British Columbia Legislative Assembly will finally be back in session on February 18th, Premier David Eby's NDP has a one-seat majority in the new post-election 93-seat legislature with cushioning from the two Greens against the 44-member Conservative opposition. Big topics during the session will include drug policy and public health, or more precisely, the NDP's management of the opioid crisis and the two-year-old decriminalization experiment here in BC. Last year, 2,253 people died in 2024, a 13% decrease from 2023, but it's still a rate of more than six deaths per day. My guest this week to talk about this is Simon Fraser University clinical psychologist, Dr. Julian Summers. He was on podcast 275 back on January 29th, 2023, right before the three-year experiment began. Will this move towards decriminalization, even just for 3 years, have any positive impact on these situations?
It isn't poised to have a positive impact. The way that we've gone about it should, in my view, lead to some concerns about not only increased harms to people who are currently at risk, but the further distribution of risk through the population. And that is principally and straightforwardly related to the resulting expansion of the sale and distribution of drugs.
And he was back on a year later on number 327. You said that decriminalization on its own would not help. You endured a criticism for that. And here we are almost exactly a year later. Your prediction has unfortunately come true. It only got worse.
More's the tragedy that the evidence that I was referring to was really not considered or even welcome for consideration by people in the provincial government. And that's both, you know, the permanent government, so what we, you know, the public service and the elected officials. They're you know, working together very closely now for a number of years on our current policy direction, but they're working in isolation.
Dr. Summers, 2 years ago, said that this was designed to fail. Here we are 2 years later with 1 year to go. What is your report card here in 2025 about decriminalization in BC?
What we've seen is almost an inevitable unfolding of what you would expect if a jurisdiction was to commit itself entirely to a focus on the supply side of drugs and essentially neglect things that influence demand for drugs and demands or risk factors that put people at likely risk for addictions. We see, for example, that the majority of people who have been dying from drug poisoning in BC are not only young people, young men, but unemployed. Now drugs have become the leading cause of unnatural death among kids in BC, this is children and youth, and the majority of those youth were clients of our Ministry for Children and Family Development, which, just to point out, has involvements with a tiny, tiny fraction of the total youth population in BC. So we've had many indications of very, very clear risk factors in our population: inadequate housing and homelessness, the growth of encampments, unemployment, untreated mental illness, and we've taken almost no action whatsoever to mitigate those risks. So, of course, to people like myself who've been studying addiction for many years and work in the field, if that's your approach, things are going to get worse. Then it gets, in a sense, even worse than that. The government has continuously denied, minimized the occurrence of scientifically predictable risks like drug diversion. And as they have been offering those increasingly implausible denials, it's created more time for additional harms to accrue. Finally, it's like the metaphorical dam breaking, and police and media, health officials are no longer able to contain the narrative. And I believe that's where we are now.
And where we are now, also, we've seen a bit of a political vacuum develop in Ottawa. Justin Trudeau is on his way out, announced his resignation January 6th. A new leader will be chosen March 9th for the Liberals, who automatically becomes the prime minister designate. Now, during his 9 years in power, he's known for legalizing marijuana nationally, but also decriminalizing hard drugs here in BC. At the same time as he is on his way out, Donald Trump is back in the White House for his second term. And of course, he's threatening tariffs on Canada and Mexico if they don't get fentanyl and illegal aliens under control. The tariffs, of course, as we know, are on hold temporarily. Trudeau has announced the hiring this week of a fentanyl czar, a former RCMP senior officer, former deputy commissioner, to look over that file as one measure that they hope to mollify Trump. But now Mark Carney is the favorite to win the Liberal leadership on March 9th and become the next Prime Minister of Canada. This week in Kelowna, he told supporters that the U.S. is experiencing a fentanyl crisis, but the word he used about it in Canada is a challenge.
Fentanyl is an absolute crisis in the United States. It's a challenge here, but it's a crisis there.
What was your reaction when you heard that from Mark Carney?
I had a hard time making sense of the remark, as I think many people did. For people who follow these issues closely, well, you don't have to follow the issue closely to realize that deaths attributable to drugs vastly exceeded all of the mortality attributable to COVID and are truly a generational crisis. In Canada, particularly in many communities, but across the board. But what was equally puzzling to me, at least, and I think to many others, is that the fact that we have this poisoning crisis is a symptom of a crisis in our public services. We have a very inadequate balance of attention to focusing on reducing supply and promoting reduction in demand and promoting wellness in the population. These are things that have been commented on at all levels, from scientific levels to the levels of Senate Commission, those people who remember the work of Michael Kirby, that we have a very dysfunctional public service for many years now as it relates to addiction and mental illness. So the fact that Mr. Carney is essentially sidestepping both the mortality problem and what it represents in terms of government inefficiency is deeply, deeply worrisome. This is an area that I focus on full time, but I think that anybody aware of how things are operating would admit that there is a two-part crisis. One is the mortality crisis. One is the dysfunction in government that is essentially contributing to that risk. And we need a leader who understands both of those and how they're connected so that we can get to a better place.
The federal government, to its credit at very least, it uses the word crisis throughout its communications. The NDP has denied and downplayed the diversion of the so-called safe supply drugs, but we've seen reporters like Fran Yenner, Paul Johnson, Adam Szivo, Jason Proctor, they've all found evidence that prescriptions were being traded even outside of the windows and doors of pharmacies. The prescriptions were traded for fentanyl and other hard drugs, basically right under the noses of the authorities and of the pharmacists. And the NDP last year, because it was an election year, they told the RCMP to keep the topic under the lid. comment very minimally on it, if at all. But of course, this month, conservative public safety critic Eleanor Sturco, who is a former RCMP officer, she's calling for public inquiry. She revealed a leaked Ministry of Health presentation about the corruption that was found in the system so far. What was your reaction to that document?
It was telling that there was, as you said, a leak. I've seen the materials, and they're fairly clear in acknowledging the scale of diversion of drugs and also the impropriety among actors in the system receiving kickbacks and other forms of payments associated with the diversion of these drugs. I think that the call for, and then we saw the health minister say in the beginning of her press conference that she thought it was regrettable that the material had been leaked. Okay, well, you know, when people tell you who they are right away, believe them. This is a part of a theme of denial and minimization. And I think the public needs to kind of ask ourselves or be informed, why would the government persist? We pointed out in my research team pointed out in about 3 years ago the risk of drug diversion. And we were hammered for our critical comments, which were not harsh. They were drawing on scientific evidence, reasons to be concerned about this new so-called safer supply, what we called a public supply of addictive drugs. The very term safer supply is a red flag. It sounds like marketing, and I'm afraid it is marketing. The origins of this are not that long. 2019, we go back to Dr. Bonnie Henry's report calling for decrim, in which she says, and I'll quote her here, 2019, as overdoses become more pervasive, both domestically and worldwide, jurisdictions are looking to BC for leadership and guidance. The stage is set for the province to meet this call, she wrote. And there's no scientific basis for that degree of confidence. So where did she get it from? Well, my answer is, all of her close colleagues were very much on side. She was following suit with the advice of the former provincial health officer, Perry Kendall, who had formed an opioid company, a former deputy provincial health officer who Dr. Henry worked alongside, Dr. Mark Tyndall, who formed an opioid vending machine company, the director of the BC Center for Substance Use, which was formed from the HIV AIDS Center, who was issuing calls to investors for his pharmaceutical company, and the scientific director of the Michael Smith Foundation, which is the major health research funder in BC, was Dr. Kendall's business partner in the opioid company. So this is a flurry of entrepreneurial activity, all related not only to the expectation that safer supply and decriminalization are going to work out well in a financial sense, but also illustrating that all these actors working in basically a concerted way believed that not that their success would likely obscure any potential appearance of conflict of interest or impropriety. And as this saga has gone on and the government has been irrationally defensive about criticism, irrationally defensive about the need to keep going and asserting more ways of making drugs available. Dr. Henry's last report in the middle of last year went further than any previous advice and said that we needed to focus on finding ways to make drugs available to people without a prescription. The tide had already shifted at that point. The chief coroner's recommendations prior, which came before Dr. Henry's, recommended basically the same thing and were regarded as dead on arrival at the legislature. So there's been this very irrational kind of clinging to a narrative over time. And I believe that part of the explanation is that many, many people behaved in ways that unfortunately involved their own self-interest against evidence. And I believe that that's also part of the explanation for why we're seeing evidence of many actors at lower levels in the system today, pharmacy operators, physicians, even people receiving drugs as patients, are behaving in ways that also are inappropriate. I believe they're following leadership from the very top. So I'm with Eleanor Sturco in her calls and other people's calls for a public inquiry. I think we need to have a careful kind of autopsy, forensic analysis of how exactly we got into this situation, why so many other promising alternatives have been continuously neglected and marginalized. And we need to have, related to that, a conversation about instituting better guardrails in the future, guardrails not only against conflicts of interest, but guardrails that affect funding. A key example is Canada has no Sunshine Act. The main center in BC that's responsible for promoting so-called safe supply acknowledges receiving funding from pharmaceutical companies, but they're under no obligation to disclose those funds completely. It's done voluntarily. That's not good enough. There are all sorts of ways that pharmaceutical companies can influence clinical behavior, research, and ultimately policies if we don't have adequate insight into how they're expending funds. So I think that there is a need for this kind of careful review of how we got into this mess. And there's also a need to review the various alternative courses of action that are available to us and have been effectively neglected or maligned even. Options that have been made prominent by major organizations, major groups, the Stanford Lancet Commission, and in fact that in some ways we see reflected in changes underway in the US as they're shifting their drug policy focus quite noticeably and putting pressure on Canada to do likewise.
Last year during the election or lead up to the election, Premier David Eby got Dr. Vigo involved as an advisor on these issues. Eby also announced baby steps towards involuntary care for people who are heavily addicted, people who are chronic criminal offenders. What do you think of the performance of David Eby on this file and the admissions that were made last year on their way to the election? Was that just convenient because it was on the way to the election? Or do you think that there is a genuine understanding there inside that this isn't working?
Well, I think if there was a genuine understanding that it wasn't working, we would have seen an articulated alternative strategy. And maybe more importantly, we would have seen steps to implement alternative ways of assisting people. I've seen neither of those things. So I'm afraid it's maybe a bit cynical, but also perhaps simply realistic to consider that people say things in the context of campaigning that they are not certain that they are going to be following through on. I don't see any evidence of follow through on those statements.
And finally, I wanted to also ask you about the announcement recently by Vancouver Mayor Ken Sim of his new strategy with the Downtown East Side. He wants to decentralize social services and housing, basically put a freeze on what's going on there, and thinks that other municipalities in Metro Vancouver should take over some of this responsibility because it's not exclusive to the Downtown East Side. This week, Mayor Sim also announced a $5 million plan for the Vancouver Police to crack down on the gangs there that are heavily involved in the drug economy in the Downtown East Side. Of course, there is a civic by-election coming up. There's a civic general election next year. And of course, we're also going to be under the international media microscope because Vancouver is one of the 16 host cities for the FIFA World Cup. So naturally, reporters from other parts of the world will be coming here and looking at the city beyond the stadium and what they will see is the Downtown East Side. What do you think of Ken Sim's strategy? Is this going the right direction? Does it have a chance to succeed?
I think that we need to remember that mayors and civic municipal councils have relatively limited powers to affect change in the thicket of problems that we're referring to that involve things like housing, reemployment, one-on-one supports, at least for periods of time, and things that really require provincial involvement. But I think that the mayor is actually on the right track, very much so in terms of the position he's taking. He isn't, in my opinion, capable of turning things around, but there's a great deal of evidence showing that the problems that we see reflected in the downtown east side, in BC's downtown east side, started off outside the metro region. 85% of the people that we've worked with who had been homeless for 10 years, living with serious addictions and mental illnesses in the downtown east side, 85% began experiencing homelessness and related problems outside metro. So there's no question, and other work that we've done has shown that there are concentrations of people. It's not equal across BC, but there are particular concentrations in communities around BC where people are struggling in an ongoing way with addiction, mental illness, homelessness, involvement with the criminal justice system. And these are in places where we know there are relatively few resources. So we've long argued, I mean, my team and groups that I've worked with have long argued that we need a provincial perspective on this, and it needs to include intervening earlier where people are experiencing problems in their communities and ensuring that the services that we're paying for, because we are paying for services, align with effective practices. And right now they don't. So the mayor is coming in and I think drawing attention to something that previous mayors of Vancouver have sidestepped. Mayor Sims' predecessor in particular rejected the points that I'm making. And even when we saw Premier Eby, when he came in as with his responsibilities for housing and AG and early on in his premiership, he said he was going to be, I think he used the word czar, downtown east side czar. That kind of went away without really much conversation. I thought it signaled a really wrong-headed approach. The guy who's responsible for the province has the best opportunity to take a provincial view. That's what we need. So I think what Mayor Sim, the way I hear him, he's saying that the problems that are being essentially borne by Vancouverites have their origins elsewhere in many, many cases. And the opportunity to intervene needs to be geographically dispersed so that we can intervene earlier and other cities and towns and their resources can play a greater role in reducing this crisis. I think he's right. And, you know, as to whether adding $5 million to policing is going to have a big effect, I'm skeptical. I'm also skeptical that anything he does, unless there are corresponding changes made in other communities and towns, especially surrounding Vancouver, this is potentially a setup for a leaf blower exercise where people who are seen as causing problems in one community are displaced to other communities where there are no greater opportunities for receiving support and reintegrating into society. So I hope that is not something that arises from this. The focus on trafficking and gangs absolutely needs to be pursued. And it's one of the consequences of our drug policy program that we've actually emboldened drug traffickers and organized criminals to take up presence in BC. That's just a horrible, horrible, very unwelcome consequence. And unfortunately, the mayor and taxpayers in Vancouver now have to pool their resources and fight back against a consequence of our own provincial policies. So there's a kind of a perverse aspect to it. But for the reasons I mentioned earlier, I think that the mayor is opening a line of discussion that is very important about the relationship between the downtown east side and other concentrated areas and responsibilities that need to be better distributed throughout the province.
Dr. Julian Summers, clinical psychologist from Simon Fraser University.
Always a pleasure talking to you, Bob. Thank you.
Now it's time on The Break. Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan.tw, former lawmaker indicted over alleged China-led election interference. Chang Shanyao was indicted over allegedly helping Beijing interfere in Taiwan's 2024 presidential election. Chang is accused of taking instructions from Chinese nationals to boost the popularity of Terry Gou, a potential presidential candidate. If found guilty, Chang could face up to 5 years in prison. Gou, who founded Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn, dropped out of the presidential contest as an independent candidate in November 2023 after failing to secure the KMT's nomination earlier in the year. In Kyoto News, Japan to release 210,000 tons from rice reserves amid surging prices. The stockpiled rice will be handed over to wholesalers in mid-March after bidding and is expected to hit store shelves between late March and early April. While the 2024 rice harvest increased by 180,000 tons from a year earlier to almost 6.8 million tons, the amount secured by major distributors as of the end of December was down by 210,000 tons. In ABC News Australia, longer video released of Sydney nurses bragging about killing Israeli patients, police await unedited version. The Israeli content creator who recorded a video of two Sydney nurses who spoke about threatening harm to Israeli patients has published a longer version online. New South Wales police say the full unedited video has not yet been sent to them. The Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency confirmed the nurses' registration has been suspended. They are Bankstown Hospital workers Ahmad Rashad Nadir and Sarah Abu Lebde. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
On Coin.com, Oregon joins lawsuit challenging Elon Musk, Doge's power grab. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield joined the lawsuit against the Department of Government Efficiency's efforts to dismantle federal agencies and their access to Americans' sensitive information held by the U.S. Treasury. The lawsuit says the Trump administration's actions have also put billions of dollars in federal funding for critical services from law enforcement, healthcare, and education at risk. In Crosscut, how Washington communities are responding to ICE deportation orders. At least 4% of state residents are undocumented, according to Pew Research. 200,000 households in Washington have at least one undocumented immigrant. At 34%, Mexico is the country with the most undocumented immigrants in Washington state. And check out the Breaker.News and BobMackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Stanley Park Preservation Society heads back to court in a bid to stop logging. And EB gave lucrative no-bid contracts to NDP friends and insiders. Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people at the Vancouver Heritage Foundation, which helps conserve heritage and keep history alive in the constantly changing city. It is Heritage Week across British Columbia from February 17th to 23rd. This year's theme is Pastimes in Past Times. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 16th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 16th of February in 1881, the Canadian Pacific Railway was incorporated? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.